More than 30 years now, Frontline, PBS's signature investigative series, has been one of the most trusted sources of news and information. They're stories with impact, and the list of those impacts is big. These are stories that have made people look and have made people listen, and the primary architect of this program is David Fanning, Frontline's executive producer since its beginning in 1983, and he joins me in the studio at WFYI this morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
When you're aiming for impact with these stories, who are you aiming for? The public or policymakers or all of the above?
Well, the interesting answer to that question is that we don't aim for impact. In fact, what we're involved in is journalism. And so we see our primary mission is to try to unwrap or unravel or tell or drive a line through a complicated set of circumstances and try to make sense of them in some way. If you do that well, and if you try to report it well, and to report it fairly and honestly and tough-mindedly, at the end of it all, you present it to the audience. You hope, as we say in the office sometimes amongst ourselves, you hope that you get the beast to blink. But you don't actually do it in order to have a particular impact. You don't try to do it to change policy. That's a different kind of journalism. That's a kind of advocacy that moves towards certain results. And so Frontline's always prided itself on its independence and on its kind of deep sense of our obligations to those kinds of rules of journalism, if you will.
Well, let's talk a bit about that. What are the essentials of that kind of journalism that has helped account for the robustness of this program over 30 plus years?
Well, it's a curious kind of alchemy that you look for, right? Because we're doing something very rare that doesn't actually exist a lot in television, anywhere else, actually. And that is to tell a long work of narrative journalism. It's at least an hour long. Sometimes it's 90 minutes. Sometimes it can even be 2 hours. But we do that without any commercial break. Now, you've got to hold an audience. If you're going to expend the kind of time and energy it takes to make a Frontline, which is 6 months, it's 9 months, it can take, it's the work of writing a book, if you will, except you have to convert it all into images, find interviews, cut it all together in ways that will make sense of it. And in addition, you need to have to tell a story. And a story, as we know from all the centuries of our lives as creatures of the theater, if you will, demand acts and prologues. And I always say every film starts with Once Upon a Time. Every film has three acts. Every film has to finally know where it's going to go to. So you're imposing a dramaturgy on something that's out there, which is a story about, if you will, the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan while we're paying attention to Iraq. We go out and do that story. We construct it in such a way that you will watch and follow the action. At the same time, we're trying to tell we're trying to be very fair to that story. We're trying to investigate it and to report it. In the case of that film, for example, when we did The Return of the Taliban in 2005, we were later told by General Eikenberry, who was running the war in Afghanistan and couldn't get the attention of the White House in 2005 because they were occupied with Iraq, that it was only when he showed our film to the White House that he got their attention. So we told the story and it had impact, but we started with the demands of journalism.
In an interview a couple of years ago in Current, the newspaper of public media, you said, here's a quote, you said, "If you can't make it important, it's probably not worth doing."
Well, I think that's right. I think, look, this is a precious, precious privilege that we have to be able to do this work. The networks have long abandoned this kind of investigative journalism, narrative documentary journalism. So we're given this precious resource, the stations. In fact, it's the stations like here in Indiana and around the country who buy into the National Programming Service of PBS, which in turn endows, if you will, or gives us the budget every year and has done for 32 years now to say, go make these programs. Well, that's precious. We sit around in the office and we think very, very hard before we say, yes, let's go do that. And we better make it important. We better sort of take on the signature stories of our time.
How do you decide what you're going to pursue, the stories you're going to pursue in a given season?
Well, you always have running lists of things that you know are important. You can't not look at the world and wonder about Putin. So it took me quite a while to figure out how to get to Putin. And how to get to Putin meant not just saying, okay, well, let's assign Putin and do this next time. It's actually an expensive idea. It's difficult. It's complicated. It was really only finding one of our colleagues, a co-production with our friends at the CBC in Canada, knowing that we could share resources. Lots of reasons that that makes a lot of sense, including the fact that the CBC has access to stock footage and other that reduced the costs to us overall. Neil Doherty, the producer, is a longtime colleague. He and I spend many, many weeks and months in edit rooms together crafting films and have done over the years. And finally, finding an access, a point of access into the Putin story. And then finding a woman, a professor, Karen DeWisher, writing a book called Putin's Kleptocracy, a source book to us. And once we put those pieces together, we were able to then go and say, let's go do the Putin film. And so we did something that was important, but it took a long time and it sort of generated itself, if you will.
There's a lot of patience involved in investigative journalism.
And you can't get caught too much by the events of the day. We do jump into Yemen and we do go and do films there, and we are fortunate at times that we can have the reflexes that are kind of closer to the drumbeat of news, if you will. But more often than not, we try to lean back and say many of these stories are continuing stories. They're going to be here next year. So if we take our time and do it right, we should just go ahead and do it right.
And so it's also, I presume, it's also about finding partners, reporting partners who have been following those issues for a long time.
Well, it's fantastic nowadays. There's been a sort of growth of, we worried a lot, of course, of the loss of investigative units at both broadcasters and particularly at newspapers. The 12,000 journalists have lost their jobs. You know, the papers have cut back on those investigative units. And much of television, by the way, 60 Minutes included, depended on local newspapers and their stories to generate stories that they would then turn into television. You know, television has always been very print dependent. It's very hard to generate investigative work. So now we turn to some of the nonprofits like ProPublica, the Center for Public Integrity, the Center for Investigative Reporting, those nonprofit newsrooms that have risen up now, the Marshall Project as well, and have done collaborations with them. There, a particular journalist has been funded for a while to work in a particular area, and he or she has gathered water behind the dam. Knowing that, we can then go in and start to think about how to make a film together.
I'm really glad that you brought up those collaborations with ProPublica and some of the other organizations. And it seems like a very natural thing for Frontline to do. But I'm wondering if there have also been some inherent obstacles or difficulties or things to work
Well, it's always difficult because we have two different mediums. And really the most interesting thing is, first of all, they're print reporters. They work in great amount of detail. They spend a long time wanting to put in sort of little sentences that kind of shape and explain. And we're stuck with interviews that we can get or can't get. Can we actually, you know, how do you make a film out of the occasional talking head, some pieces of paper in a guilty building? You know, you have to kind of make a film out of it somehow. And when you've constructed all of this very carefully, we spent a year investigating a assisted living company, looking at records of the, you know, around the country and finding accounts and stories of people who, you know, abuse within this company. And finally, at the end of the day, the print reporters wanted to add all kinds of extra sentences and additional pieces of information when the film is just about, with all of its pieces and film and sound effects and edits and all the rest of it, about to be ready for broadcast. And you're tearing your hair out saying, no, 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 we can't do that. But okay, we have to be fair. Let's try to figure this out together. And so those are the difficulties. But they're mostly transmedia problems. They're not collegial. Because really, ultimately, you can only be as good and as smart and as trustworthy as your producers and your reporters. And they need to be able to connect with each other in a trusting way. And so any number of editors can sit around and say, let's collaborate. But unless you can get the reporters to collaborate, you know, you can't really do them.
One of the things that Frontline has done especially successfully and pretty early was to extend itself into the digital space, onto the web. And so I'm wondering if part of that transmedia tension that you're describing just a moment ago can also be leveraged to alter the good in the digital space. And if so, how have you gone about doing that?
I think that's exactly true. We came in very early, 1995. We were on the web. We did one of the first deep content editorial websites in history. We were able to publish all of the transcripts of our interviews, the source materials and others. And that does make a difference. You can actually go to people who you're going to interview and say, look, your interview will be published on the web. You can trust us to talk to us. You can also, because you can go and look at the source materials, be able to judge our journalism, if you will. That also means that you can footnote. You can, in fact, put into these films kind of layers of additional information that anybody can reach and access. That's terrific. Now, indeed, we also have to use the web to reach an entirely new audience that doesn't come to television. So increasingly, part of the deliverables, if you will, that we ask of any of our producers is not just make an hour-long film. We need you to make 3 or 4 or 5 shorter pieces as well that will then go on YouTube and go on a YouTube channel and will also be virally sent around through social media, you know, into Facebook, into other places, in order to reach a generation that doesn't, frankly, tune in at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night. And so we do need to reach those people. And the web is this extraordinary new platform that we're all learning to navigate.
And I read also that you were instrumental in developing like an iPad app for Frontline.
Well, yes, we're looking at it, and it's still a work in progress, because really the idea that you do a seminal work, you do a big film that takes an enormous amount of effort to do, the idea that you have gathered so much material, much of which doesn't see the light of day, the opportunity to layer behind and with that film all those additional elements, all the additional intellectual content, the sort of side roads, if you will, some of those other stories that didn't quite make the film but are still fascinating in their own right. The iPad gives us an opportunity to see it, to watch the film, to turn the iPad and to see the script at the same time, tracking the film as it goes, using that script as a matrix into which we can put all these additional material, is a wonderful opportunity to publish in a deep sense. You know, the thing about television was that you spent 6 months or 9 months making a film. You crafted it within an inch of its life. It's like fine joinery, like making a fantastic cabinet that you'd made, and then one night you threw it in the air. And some of it hit the satellite and came back, and the rest went to Mars. It was gone, you know, at 9 o'clock at night, slipped through the fingers. And only the occasional person who had access to a VHS tape could ever see it again. This has changed everything we do. And in a way, it changes the contract you make with the work you do. You say, okay, I'm not making this for one night at 9 o'clock. I'm making this for the long term, for the future. That matters. That matters in the attention you pay to it, and matters in the way in which you approach it.
Also, we're talking about Frontline's use of the digital space. Also makes me think about a guiding principle of your work that you've been very fierce about over time, and that is your insistence on transparency. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Well, it actually happened in that very first moment when we were sitting around in the office and looking at the end of our cut on Waco, the inside story about David Koresh and the FBI. And we had audio tapes of the interviews that the FBI conducted, the negotiations that they had done with Koresh. And I kept saying, well, we've only used fragments in the documentary. Can't we put them somewhere else? Can we make a radio show out of this? And someone said, you can put this on the web. When I said, really? We can put it on the web? What else can we put up? And they said, well, whatever you like, you can put documents up. And that's when I decided that we should put the interviews up. And my producers were very resistant to it. They said, those are our work product. We don't usually share those. We make the editorial decisions. I said, no, we're going to publish these at length. We will edit for repetition and legal reasons and, you know, but let's publish them. And in that act of doing it, we will actually make our journalism transparent. And I thought that was a profound act in terms of what we do. It keeps us honest in a way that, you know, we always set out to be honest, but it keeps us honest in some very special way.
I think that it does. It keeps you honest in such a way as the program can and has taken some, you know, really extraordinary risks, and not in terms of the journalism, but in terms of subject matter, sometimes to the chagrin of funders, of other parties, and there's been some pressure.
Well,
let's
you
be
just
honest.
Do what you have to do. I mean, you do what you have to do. You set out to do stories that you think are important, and you just you go ahead and do them. We've never wanted to be stuck in an ideological box. We've never wanted to sort of ever be, pegged with taking sides, unless, of course, we've come to some conclusion about a story that is so profoundly important to tell, and nobody else will talk to us on the other side of that argument. We're gonna say, here's the evidence that this shows, you know, and we're gonna defend it, and we're gonna make sure that we're completely tight about the journalism. So, you know, I think that just goes with the territory.
What issues are you committed to now at Frontline?
Well, I mean, I'm always interested, and the Middle East continues to tear itself apart. I mean, we will continue to do stories in the Middle East. We're right in the middle of doing a film called Obama at War, and we're also going to be looking at, you know, I think in a way continue to look at the limits of American power and our influence in this region. We'll be looking at Iran. We can't help but look at what happened between Netanyahu and Obama. There's a thread of a story there that we think is important to keep following. I just have been interested pushing a film forward. We did a four-hour film called Drug War, and in the late 90s, and we're coming back to that. And it's sort of what's happened to the drug war, the last days of the drug war. The drug war is being redefined now. It's everybody who's in that business is now said that there's a sort of moment of real reevaluation and change. That's an important story that goes to it. We've been in a long, two-year-long commitment to a film in immigration inside the Congress following that. And yet we'll also do films as surprising as a film called Growing Up Trans, about transgender, which is a moving, powerful, extraordinarily delicate film that I'm very proud of, and that's going to go out at the end of June. So the series will always keep ranging across all kinds of subjects.
And one final question, I guess, about the place of this program in the world of public broadcasting. What concerns you, if anything, about the future of public broadcasting, particularly as it concerns the kind of work that you've been doing over these years at Frontline?
Well, first of all, we've had extraordinary support from public broadcasting to do this work. And I think that that's in its own way a great tribute to public broadcasting, that they want this work and continue to support it. I think the great challenge of public broadcasting is, in fact, the digital age. And, you know, as we are challenged as broadcasters to move into these other platforms, and how we manage to make that transition is really important. We have a tremendously close relationship to our membership. We need to bring our members with us into that space. We have a relationship to our audience that's actually rather different from most broadcasters. We have a very direct relationship to our very loyal viewers. So let's take them with us into this new age and figure out a new model of membership and partnership in the age. That's the way in which we can build public broadcasting.
David Fanning, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
David Fanning is the executive producer of Frontline.